Good morning. This meeting is now in session. My name is Angela Ryder. I am the chair of the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy. It is Monday, March 25th, 2024 at 9 a.m. and I'm calling this meeting to order. Folks on this video conference, please mute yourselves until it is your opportunity to speak or if you've been called upon to eliminate distractions of background noise. The chair of the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy reserves the right to change the order of items published on this agenda, except for public hearings set for a specific time. During the board meeting and upon a vote of the majority of a quorum, the board may go into executive session to obtain legal advice from the board's attorney pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A3 on any items listed on the agenda. All meeting attendees whose presence is not required in an executive session may remain in the board meeting room when the board withdraws to chambers for the executive session. Any and all legal action by board members will only take place during open session. Executive Director Augerton, will you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member Tapscott?
Present.
Board Member Kovitz?
Present.
Vice Chair DeRoost?
Present.
Chair Ryder?
Present.
Four present, one vacant.
Thank you. At this time, I would like to welcome our newest board member, Robert Kovitz, to the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy as our newest public board member. Robert or Bob, do you prefer Bob?
I prefer Bob. Thank you.
Okay. Bob, would you please go ahead and introduce yourself to the board members and to the public at this time?
Hi, it's good to see all the board members here. I'm Bob Kovitz. I'm in Tucson, Arizona, and spent many, many years in the personal services, massage, skincare, resort industry, but retired about 24 years ago from that specific industry. But I'm interested in what the board is doing and interested in protecting the public and the state and everybody involved in the personal care business.
Thank you so much for joining us and helping us out as well. Item number three on the agenda is a call to public pursuant to ARS 38-431.01H. The board may make an open call to the public during the public meeting, which is subject to a reasonable time. The cutoff time is 2 minutes and will be timed by board staff. We will place manner and restrictions to allow individuals to address the public body on any issues that are within the jurisdiction of the public body. However, members of the board are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and legal action. The board, however, may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that the matter be put on a future agenda. Please be advised that a call to public is not an opportunity for testimony for cases that are being reviewed by the board, and again, must be within the jurisdiction of the public body. Do we have a call to public? Please raise your hand on the meeting screen. Ms. Hatcher.
Sorry, I forgot to unmute myself. I just wanted to congratulate you guys, and it was a fight well fought, and I know you're still in it. I just was curious what you'd mapped out for the future, seeing how the contract isn't up until 2025, and if you're getting the much-needed support that you can get, as much as you can get in moving forward. That's the first part. I just wanted to say congratulations to everybody, but you know, the person answering the phones need help. You guys need money, access to your money to move forward. And I just wondered what that looked like, if you knew what that looked like. Also, I wanted some clarification on out-call massage. As I read it, when a person is mobile, and I do work in the hotel spa industry, after owning my own business for 18 years, I am inside a resort, and I see therapists come in after hours. A lot of times they're not pulling a table. So I want to know what the clarification is, because as I read it, It is an actual mobile entity that the patrons go in. It is not a therapist that goes inside a hotel. And as I read it, it states that the facility is to be zoned and coded, and that's not hotel rooms per the city. Plus, and this is just an example, if Chandler and Gilbert's alcohol or period massage time ends at 9 p.m., then you shouldn't be having a therapist come in at 10, 11, 3 in the morning, because you can't start before 6 a.m. And in certain cities, the cutoff time is somewhere between 6 and 9. So if I could just get clarification, that'd be great. I realize I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hatcher. Director, if we could put that, notate that so that we can discuss that at a future meeting, I would appreciate it. That is definitely something to look into. Do we have any other calls to public? And it appears that we do not, so we will move on to the next agenda item, number 4, declaration of board member conflicts of interest. Board members should have had an opportunity to review the board packet sent out by staff. Are there any conflicts of interest regarding the cases or investigative reviews that we are conducting today?
No.
And there are not. Item number 5 on the agenda, board members should have had an opportunity to review the open meeting minutes from October 23rd, 2023. Seems like an eternity ago. Are there any questions or discussions to be had regarding these open meeting minutes? And there are not. I move that the board accept the open meeting minutes from October 23rd, 2023. May I have a second?
This is Vice Chair DeRuth, and I'll second that motion.
Thank you. And could we do a voice vote? Please go ahead and unmute and state your name and approval or opposition, beginning with Vice Chair, followed by Board Member Tapscott and Kovitz.
Vice Chair DeRuth, and aye.
Board Member Tapscott, aye.
Board Member Kovitz abstained because I wasn't at the meeting.
Thank you. And Chair Ryder, aye. The motion passes. Item number 6 on the agenda, we have the one and only Ms. Mara Concordia, who was the very first chair of the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy and is currently the chair on the Massage Therapy Industry Issues Advisory Committee. Ms. Mara Concordia, would you have an update for the board at this time regarding the advisory committee or any proposed suggestions to the board? And you might be muted.
Good morning. Thank you for all of that. So first, I want to say thank you to all of the volunteers on the advisory committee and others who were just in the community throughout the state for all of their efforts in communicating our positions about HB 2169. We are all very grateful that it has been stopped, and our efforts have definitely paid off. I just wanted to share, because there were some questions, you know, what exactly the advisory committee has been advising on. And so during that process, myself, as well as, of course, yourself, Chair Ryder, and Tom Arterton, executive director, have met with the representatives and their staff on multiple occasions, bringing forth all of the collected information from the industry and supporting that with handouts, documents, and most importantly, solutions for some of the concerns. I'm sorry. Did someone say something? Okay. So, and of course, as everyone is aware, you've already implemented some of those recommendations, one of which is approving the submission of applications sooner for the to begin the background checks earlier, so that new graduates would have a reduced wait time potentially for their licenses. I understand the progression of automation has been moved forward as well and is being escalated. So those were recommendations that were made and things that perhaps were already to some degree in process of the automation and so forth, but has been escalated. In addition to that, we provided recommendation about reaching out to some champions in the House of Representatives who expressed interest in helping us to potentially get future legislative needs handled. So we have had outreach to ask for a bill folder to be opened to address the extension of the board since the expiration will be June of 25. And of course, to see if there's anything that can be done about our funding concerns. We also have been notified, as you all are aware, of the governor's regulatory rule and regulatory committee review, which has been amazingly 5 years already, and that will be coming forth in June. So we have been meeting about that, and we are at the ready should you have any needs from us in that process, although we feel fairly confident that that there won't be any needs, hopefully, for that. In addition, we have a brief meeting scheduled for tomorrow with yourself and Executive Director Tom Augerton to discuss the most important needs that the board faces at this moment, which another person has already identified several of those. At that point, we will then put together a full advisory committee meeting to see what we can do to help address any of those issues or be of assistance in any kind of a way. Originally, I did call to have a meeting on Wednesday of this week, but I have not heard back yet if that meets everybody's schedules. So the date is to be determined. And then in conclusion, again, I want to just thank certainly everyone on the board and the board staff for all of their extra hours and work and contributions to assisting the industry in helping with HB 2169 and to get everything communicated to the proper representatives and staff so that we can continue to ensure public safety and create smooth flow for current and future licensees, the people we serve. So that's my report for today. Do you have any questions?
I do not have any questions. Other board members? Well done. Thank you so much for that, Mara.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Item number 7 on the agenda. I've been waiting for a long time for this, and we have a very special speaker presentation today being provided by Chris Mueller-Tabanera, as well as his colleague, Kate Adams, is joining us today. And I believe we will need some assistance from the almighty Tony IT person, maybe, to assist with the presentation portion of it if you have a PowerPoint or something that you would like to share. Chris is from he is the chief strategy officer from what is called the network. They're an anti-trafficking organization, and I would like to just hand it right over to Chris to introduce himself. I did see this presentation at the FSMTB conference last year, and it was a real eye-opener. I'm so glad that these meetings get recorded so that they can be reviewed at a later date for people who were unable to attend the meeting. This is crucial in people understanding the severity of what is happening in our industry and just all over in the country. So Chris, welcome. Thank you so much for being here, and the virtual floor is yours.
Thanks, Angela. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate the invitation to be here, and we're going to go through a lot of content in a short amount of time. So we're going to do a big overview on human trafficking in the illicit massage industry. And I'm again just grateful to have your attention today. Knowing that we can't cover everything, but as Angela mentioned, I hope cover some things that really shed light on the reality of this space that's sort of creeping in and sort of like being the thorn in the side of the legitimate industry, and really talk through how do we actually come up with a collaborative response. So let me see if I can share my screen. Yes. And if there's a special way that I need to do that, let me know.
It should be a little icon on the bottom of the screen that says present now.
Okay, it's denying me from doing it. Any questions on?
That's going to be Tony.
When you do the selection with the up arrow,
yeah.
And then it asks, what do you want, a tab or a window? A tab is going to be something that's running on your browser. A window is going to be something like PowerPoint. And then you have to choose the PowerPoint choice that's there behind it for it to work right. Because it will have a selection of, well, which one do you want? And it might be under the window that we're talking on. So you might not see it unless you do a Alt tab, and then it will show all the different screens you have.
Okay, it says I can't do it, but it looks like I can reload and it should work. So I'm going to be right back, everybody. I apologize.
Oh, okay.
See you in a second.
Hey, I see a presentation. Good job.
But you're muted.
Chris, are you muted? You are muted.
Okay.
Oh, there we go. Hey, that happened a lot faster than it normally does, so good job.
All right. Hey, I'm trying here. All right, do you guys see the screen now?
Yes, we do.
You do. Okay. All right. If for some reason this stops working, just shout at me, and we'll get going. All right. I just want to acknowledge as we jump in today, there may be so many of us coming from different on the spectrum of how we kind of engage this issue. Some of us may be totally neutral. Some of us are knowledgeable of kind of the exploitation that's happening in this space, and it's very making me fired up. And some may be feeling like, oh, man, we've been talking about this a lot. Isn't this somebody else's issue? So just holding the space in the virtual room as we talk about this, because again, I do believe that everybody has a role, whether it's law enforcement, legislators, or service providers. But I think those in the massage therapy space actually have a potential for outsized impact in being able to confront and combat what's happening in this space. And I'm happy to kind of engage and talk with you how we do that. So as Angela mentioned, I work for the network. We are a counter-human trafficking organization. We provide data, intelligence, and different strategy to help support collaborative efforts in combating the industry of trafficking that's happening within these spaces. Our sole focus, and I would argue that makes us unique, is that this is our only thing that we do, is focusing on how illicit actors and traffickers are using the guise of massage, and this is our one and only specialization. We're going to go through four big things. We're going to give a little bit of history and background of how we got here. We're going to talk about the present reality of what we're seeing today. We'll do a deeper dive into the victimization and kind of the narrative that's often happening for those who are exploited in this space, and talk a little bit about the future. How do we move forward? How do we combat this industry within our space? And so big question we always want to ask is, like, how did we get here? And I just want to name the illicit massage industry is massive, and it did not happen overnight. There are so many things that I would argue were the seeds that gave root to this exploitive environment that is, again, co-opting these names like massage and legitimate industries for the sake of its own benefit. And if I would say there are three historical things that to me are the foundational seeds of what we now see as the legacy of that today in illicit massage. And the three words I would say are policy, conflict, and the media. Policy, conflict, and the media are the core things for me that shape how we got eventually to what we see today. And when we talk about policy, what I'm talking about is that in the mid to late 1800s, there was an institutionalization of anti-Asian sentiment within our immigration law. And this is important to name because this isn't, again, something that happened yesterday or 20 years ago, but decades and centuries ago, in the 19th century, you have legislation like the Page Act, or legislation like the Chinese Exclusion Act, that fueled racist sentiment, particularly to East Asian communities. And even more specific, calling out what was seen as a threat from those from East Asia of sexual temptation and lewd and immoral activity. And this created, I would argue, within a dominant culture or majority culture within the U.S., this anti-Asian sentiment and this hostility to a particular group of people. And we have to name this because it fuels part of what we see when we think about stereotyping and dynamics today. The Chinese Exclusion Act was the first policy within the United States that particularly targeted one specific ethnic group and barring them from entry into the United States. And even calling out from that, not just Chinese, but particularly females and female immigrants and the threat that it would be to the dominant majority culture. And again, the reason this is so important is that you have this institutionalization, not just prejudice per se in somebody's mind or prejudice within certain communities, but prejudice that then was institutionalized and legalized in how we interacted with as a country, those who were coming in from East Asia. And what this was also critical in doing was that it completely distorted those that were coming into the country and created a great gender imbalance. So what you end up seeing is that in the transition from forced labor and slavery of African Americans, you have this gap in quote unquote a cheaper unpaid workforce. So from a business standpoint, the U.S. economy needed to fill that vacuum. And so what did it do? It ended up allowing in some of those from East Asia. But what you created, because there was this perspective that we wanted East Asian men, you created this great gender imbalance of those who were coming into the United States were Asian men without any family, without any females. And so what this creates, again, are the dynamics of a market of being able to fuel what ends up becoming the prostitution of Asian women for these purposes. Policy is one element that fuels this. The other thing I would just name is conflict, conflict, conflict. When you look back into the early 1900s and into the 1940s and 50s and 60s, is the rising conflict between Asian powers and imperialism as well as the U.S. imperialism. Now, again, just naming the reality of how you back this up. What you had years ago at the turn of the 1900s in the war effort for Japanese created what was called comfort stations. Some of us might know this from history, okay? But it was legal to have prostitution in Japan. And as Japan started beefing up their war effort, they would put comfort stations all over their imperial space. And what this did was they would traffic and ultimately forcibly move Asian women to serve in these brothels and military prostitution for those who were at war. The reason this is important to name is because when there was a massive transition in the war effort, the U.S. took over all of these establishments. And instead of seeing these establishments saying these are horrible and these need to be gotten rid of, how could they be doing this? The U.S. basically became an ally, in effect, by continuing to exploit women in these comfort stations. And they just started changing the name, going from comfort to rest and recreation, rest and relaxation, again, where you're dealing with the trauma of war through the exploitation of women. And so you see this effort and this massive trafficking and exploitation of East Asian women in these camp towns or in these recreation centers, quote unquote, as a euphemism, ultimately to cover what was forced prostitution. And so you create who are those willing to be exploited and what does that look like and who is ultimately benefiting when we think about power dynamics. So when you think about policy around that same time, the arising conflict between America and the Asian Pacific, you throw into that what I would argue is the media. Throughout the 1900s, even till today, you have this eroticized, hypersexualized and objectified perspective of Asian females. And you see this collision of both policy as well as the conflict within the war effort making its way into mainstream mass media as we understand it. Whether we're talking about The World of Susie Wong, Madame Butterfly, Miss Saigon, or some of us might even remember Full Metal Jacket, you start having this collision of these perspectives now making its way into mass media. And what this again creates is a perspective. And ultimately a dehumanizing stereotype of Asian women and their desire or their perspective of needing to fulfill the sexual appetites of men. Whether it's the dragon lady or the China doll, as we often refer to it, again, this perspective of this submissive sexual object to serve white males when we think about prostitution. And so none of this happens overnight. Again, we see this even within movies like Austin Powers, there is a sexual object and a dehumanization, ultimately stereotyping those Asian women. And so why do I bring all this up? I bring this up because as we think about today, it's important to understand the prejudice roots that gave ultimately the legacy to what we have now in the illicit massage industry. So whether we're going back hundreds of years, seeing these roots, or whether we're looking about more recently in the last 20 years, the challenges that the anti-trafficking field has faced when combating this industry, all pouring into what we see today. So when I think about the anti-trafficking movement, largely I think of a few things. One, the response has been reactive. It's felt like a whack-a-mole approach. There's been a gross misunderstanding of the problem of this particular type of trafficking, often for those who are being victimized. There are massive cultural and language barriers between those who are trying to intervene and help, whether that's service providers or whether that's law enforcement. You have often this use of an undercover approach as the only tool to kind of combat these establishments, which creates a bunch of risk when we think about it. Human trafficking investigations are all difficult and long, no matter the victim, but they're particularly challenging when it comes to the illicit massage industry and potentially lacking a victim cooperation, as well as conflict in the space between often nonprofits and law enforcement agencies. And I would say one of the greatest challenges that have led to sort of the proliferation of this industry is arresting women. Ultimately, putting women into the criminal justice system who are victims or potentially exploited workers themselves. And so I name all of this because whether we're talking about historical artifacts today that are pouring into the industry, when we think about the anti-trafficking movement, it has largely been incompetent in how it's responding or using the wrong tools. And just naming, however we move forward, and as we talk about that in the presentation, we have to sort of talk about reality, name reality, and be willing to kind of shift our paradigm in how we address it. All right, let's talk about, again, if that's sort of some of the historical fuel to the fire, what does the industry look like today? What do we, when we think about the illicit massage industry, kind of count it as? Well, again, defining what this is, I would argue that the illicit massage industry is one of the largest networks of sex trafficking in the United States, and it consists of these establishments that put on the facade of a legitimate business only to facilitate commercial sex. And so as we look at our online data, looking at the digital footprint of these businesses online, we're looking at approximately 13,000 businesses in every state across the country. To give you some perspective, if you were to take every KFC and every Burger King and combine those storefront locations, it still is less than the size of the illicit massage industry. The industry since 2019, as we've been measuring it, grows about 9% a year. So over the last 4 years, we're having an upward growth trend of about 38%. And again, if you look at demand studies that are studying the customer traffic of sex buyers at these establishments, these demand studies have been replicated in multiple cities, Houston, Dallas, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Fairfax, Virginia, Atlanta, Georgia, Denver, Colorado. You can estimate, again, very conservatively, that this industry as a whole is generating around $5 billion in illicit revenue every year. So wherever you go, this industry is a problem. Whether you're eating burritos in San Diego, whether you're listening to Nirvana and grunge rock in Seattle, whether you're choosing green sauce over red sauce in Albuquerque, whether you're weeping over the Dallas Cowboys and their continued mediocrity, or partying in South Beach in Florida, or even if you're shaking hands with politicians where we are out here in Northern Virginia, the industry is problematic. And so even if you zoom into Arizona, right, again, just looking what we can find online, you're upwards of 360 illicit massage businesses in the state that you see clustered in the areas of Maricopa County, Pima County. Again, majority of these are going to be in that Phoenix metro area and then some in Tucson. In Phoenix, in Maricopa, you have around 250 IMBs. So the overwhelming majority are kind of in that space. So again, it's a problem that is national, but it is hyper-local no matter where you are, that we're all struggling to combat. And now it's important to remind that, again, illicit massage is a business like any other businesses, and there is no inevitability that you are successful in business. So what is making these illicit actors so successful? Here are just the ways that we sort of comprehend it, and this will help us shape how we move forward. So I'm going to plant this seed now. We kind of call three big things: the safe haven, the feeling of impunity, and what we'll call a controllable workforce are what we think are helping drive profitability in the illicit massage industry. When we say safe haven, it really is just the storefront. It's where, from a business standard standpoint, supply meets demand, and it gives traffickers and sex buyers this feeling of plausible deniability. Okay? The second, impunity, is really this lack of accountability from any enforcement, criminal or civil, giving folks within this trafficking world a feeling of invincibility. And lastly, this controllable workforce, a continued access over this group of workers who are experiencing many vulnerabilities. So from a business standpoint, this idea of an endless supply. And so this is what we would argue are some of the things that are driving the nature of these businesses to be profitable within our communities. So let's dive deep into some of how these things work and talk about operations. And again, I'm going to try and use as many pictures as possible to make it easier to remember and not have you read a bunch of text. Now, here's something that I would name. I would say, similar to McDonald's, wherever you go into the country, when you order a Big Mac, you sort of know what to expect. All McDonald's sort of look, feel, smell the same way. And whenever you're kind of purchasing something, you know what to get, you know what's on the menu. Now, that model will ultimately fail, but just as an example, this franchise type of idea is similar to how the illicit massage business operates. Wherever you go in the country, no matter who you're talking to, they sort of look like and operate in a very similar fashion. And similar to fast food chains, we have this franchise model where often there is an entity or a couple or an individual mamasan who owns 2 to 3, 4, 5 businesses at a time. You don't necessarily have what you would think of as a snakehead that's sort of sitting back in another country, controlling all of these establishments across the country. That's much more decentralized into these regional and local networks. And now from what we see and through so much case study and analysis and our work on the ground is that the overwhelming majority of these networks are Chinese. And what I mean by that is the traffickers, the bosses, and even the victims are going to be from China. And as far as how these keep going, there are so many people who have a hand in these operations. I mean, there are so many enablers, not just a trafficker and a boss, but there are so many people contributing to this problem. Just to name a few, establishers. These are often folks within the illicit industry who are just popping up businesses and immediately selling them. Their gift is establishing a business and then offloading it to a buyer. Paper husbands. These are folks who are often former sex buyers who forge a relationship with someone within a regional boss or a local boss to help then help with paperwork and get around all the sort of legalese that's necessary to operate a business. But it's just a husband on paper. They're not actually someone who is living together and raising a family. Whether it's accountants to help falsify tax records, attorneys, couriers who are moving money and moving women, as well as these fake diploma mills, as we call it, these fake massage schools. These are all these people and different entities that are enabling this industry to thrive. So in addition to that, like any business, you need to advertise to their customers. And so these establishments are often advertising on illicit websites. So I list a couple here, whether it's Skip the Games or USA Sex Guide, that again are sort of putting these explicit photos out, tagging a business address and a phone number to recruit to their target customer. Legitimate massage therapy businesses and legitimate massage therapists are not going to be advertising on Backpage Gals because that's not the customer they're going to. But for these businesses, if you Google their phone number just as an exercise, you'll start seeing advertisements on these sites pop up, ultimately to get in front of these folks, the buyers. Buyers, if you've done any research on this, the majority of buyers who are using the most money are those who make spending the most money within the commercial sex space are going to be making over $100,000 a year. Okay. And Demand Abolition did a study, and it was so interesting. One of the things that they mentioned was that they surveyed buyers, and it says, what is your favorite venue? And the favorite venue for sex buyers, particularly those who are high-frequency buyers, buyers who buy sex every week or every month, noted that illicit massage establishments are their favorite venues to purchase sex. Again, I would argue it's because there is a very low-risk environment for them to do it. And so, again, speaking generally, there are so many minimal expenses when it comes to starting up these businesses if you have an incredibly high revenue when it comes to operating them. So you don't need to go to Harvard Business School, but when you have minimal expenses and high revenue, ultimately what that leads to is a whole lot of cash and an incredibly profitable business structure. So these are some of the operations when we think about these businesses that are really dotting the entire country. So you guys might easily be able to spot these. So what are those red flags? What are those red flags for lithium massage businesses that kind of wherever you go, you sort of see them? One, you often see that they're covered up from the front and you can't see in when you come to these establishments. There's often high security measures and these closed caption TV cameras, closed circuit TV cameras, usually with the camera over the front entrance, over the main hall, as well as the back. And again, ways that they can monitor what's happening that, again, are just usually not present when you think about legitimate establishments. Another security measure for these businesses is often they're closed. The door will be locked during the day, particularly if these businesses only have one or two females who are in the premises. If they're providing any form of massage, they're often locked the door. Again, another security measure, or having to be sort of let in through a phone call or a buzzer. These are, again, high security measures that you see at these establishments. Another major red flag, primarily only male customers who are coming to these businesses. Being able to see evidence that folks are living on site at these establishments and ultimately habitating in these commercial spaces. Another red flag, again, given the nature of the business, is that you have a ton of cash often in hand and stashed in these establishments. Late hours, odd hours. Often these businesses never close. Even if the lights go out, if a buyer sees an advertisement and calls the phone, and someone will answer. And I've known this, again, seen this years and years and years over doing this work, just the incredibly odd hours that these businesses have. You often see just falsified or just completely incorrect licenses and permits to operate these establishments. You might see like a parallel license, like for aesthetician, or cosmetology. And again, just trying to veil legitimacy, we'll put them in a frame and put it up in the business, even though they clearly do not have the proper permits or education to be practicing. Another obvious red flag is, again, evidence of sexual activity, the inappropriate clothing or quote unquote uniform that's being worn in these establishments, just the incredible advertising online and illicit sites, as well as what sex buyers are talking about from frequenting these establishments. So again, whether it's these red flags of what you're seeing online, whether it's what women are wearing, whether it's clearly the evidence of folks living on site, the odd hours or the customers who are going, these are just some of the red flags as we think about these businesses within our communities. So let's shift for a little bit, going from not just what we think about from the historical standpoint and how these businesses are operating in our communities, and talk about how does this happen? How does victimization occur? What does trafficking ultimately look like? Well, for some of us on this call, we can even acknowledge, even from our own stories, kind of that American dream, quote unquote, narrative, and just the reality of, hey, if my family come to the United States, we have the opportunity to make it, and it is going to be better than it is from wherever we're coming from. And some of us have that story. The reality is so many victims are being caught up in that same narrative, that they are being told if they come to the United States, they will find work, they will earn money, and they will be able to have a better life and take care of their family. And often what I say when training about trafficking is that trafficking always seems to start with a lie. Just a little twist of the truth to try and convince someone that what they're doing and what they're going to ultimately encounter will be for their benefit. If we look at the demographics, again, of who is being victimized in these spaces, the overwhelming majority, again, are going to be East Asian or Southeast Asian. And again, that's not an accident as we think about the historical roots of where this problem and this market kind of dynamic was created and then ultimately present here in the States. The overwhelming majority in the country, I'm going to say, are Chinese. And then something important to note is that for those who are being victimized is their age. We're talking about adult female immigrants or recent migrants who are between 30 and 60. This is important because, again, this is not accidental, right? Just giving you one example of this. If you were to just Google search the term Shang Nu or leftover women, you will have a ton of articles and even videos on YouTube showing sort of PSAs around this concept. And what this is, again, is in China, there is this concept of if you are mid to late 20s, single, unmarried, or divorced and without children, you are quote unquote left over and no one wants you. And this is a palpable thing for many of the victims here in the United States. That was a push factor of them coming to the United States. Again, there are so many factors that contribute to this, but just one of these sort of sociological environmental factors about what it's like to potentially be a 30-year-old female who is either divorced or unmarried and what that pressure would be like in their community. And again, just giving this as one example of, again, this isn't accidental when we think about who is being exploited and why. And someone much smarter than me years ago once said, traffickers don't exploit people, they exploit vulnerabilities. And again, that same thing applies when we think about victims in illicit massage. So whether we're talking about their age and their employability, whether we're talking about English language skills, access to education, maybe former experience with domestic violence, incurring debt, not having a lot of job skills or an unstable immigration status, or again, no formal work authorization. These are all vulnerabilities that traffickers and bosses know how to exploit for women in illicit massage, as it again goes for anyone in trafficking. For many women, again, whether they were trafficked and kind of had high contact with a trafficker from source country to here, or whether they were able to get to the United States on their own and not have any access to legitimate work, they're often, again, journey starts with a lie through some form of fraudulent recruitment. The majority of this now is all digital, and particularly through the app WeChat. So this is, again, I just pulled this. This is a very common kind of message and advertisement recruiting for workers, talking about good work, great pay, easy hours, safe community, learning on the job, okay, and who to call. Again, and we know often as these ads are talking about, hey, you don't need any education. We can just train you. For those of us in the U.S., in this industry, we know that that's not true. You can't obviously just pop into a massage establishment and start working, okay? But again, simple ways that women are recruited into this space. Debt bondage. Debt bondage is a critical way to, again, enforce coercive control over women. Doing a study in New York years ago in my former organization, we studied particularly those who met the definition of trafficking, who are Chinese females, being exploited in illicit massage. The average debt for those individuals was $40,000. Debt that could be to a trafficker, debt could be to someone back home. You name it, again, that vulnerability is often being exploited when we think about women in illicit massage. I mentioned high security. Again, victims are often coerced and controlled through being surveilled consistently. I'll never forget a story of a woman that I worked with years ago. She was trafficked in multiple states down the Eastern Corridor, all the way up from Massachusetts to North Carolina. And the first time that she was encountered a sex buyer at illicit massage and quickly learned what was really going on, I remember her telling me that, hey, the boss told us that they had all these cameras to protect the workers and keep them safe from bad customers and any bad actors. And she quickly learned after that first day that was a lie, and that these cameras were to monitor them, to consistently know that somebody is watching. The amount of stories I've heard of women who, again, leave out the front door, even if it's just to go across the street or to go to get something to eat, will immediately get a message saying, what are you doing? Where are you going? You need to go back in the store. From someone that they've never met is just, again, something I hear all the time because they're being watched, right? Not necessarily from someone who's in the establishment, but from who's watching, whether you're talking about someone in LA or someone in Flushing, New York, being able to monitor the movement of these women. So this constant control of movements and being watched. The amount of sexual violence that is occurring in these spaces is insane. My background is in direct services and overseeing teams who work directly with survivors. And the words from assessments and working with women who experience so much trauma, again, just to name reality, these are what you consistently hear that is normal for women living in these establishments and working in these establishments. Being assaulted, beaten, hit, groped, raped, robbed. I'll never forget a woman who shared about being dragged to the bathroom by her hair. These stories, again, are normal when it comes to these establishments. And let's not take this normalized trauma and look at it as it's not a problem because people aren't talking about it, but acknowledge, hey, if this is really what's happening, how can we get smarter in protecting these women and responding to these establishments? And the last thing I'll name when it comes to victimization and illicit massage, from recruitment or control is the idea of coercion. The majority of women being exploited in these spaces isn't going to be directly through force from a trafficker. It's going to have elements of fraud, but the major element is this coercion and these psychological threats that are using so many cultural values and twisting them ultimately to coerce and control women to feeling like they cannot leave and they have no other choice. For the sake of time, I'm just going to name these and just say, hey, if you guys want to see more of this and hear more about these elements of victimization, how culture is a factor, it's not the reason, it's not the problem, but how traffickers utilize culture ultimately to exploit women, you can go to our website. We have a short video of a number of experts featured talking about this. And again, I really highly encourage you to watch that. You can even hear someone who's on our team, who's a former survivor of the illicit massage industry. She shares her story of being trafficked. So again, you get a little bit of an inside look of what's actually happening in these establishments. Okay, we've covered a lot. We've talked about victimization and gone through that. We've talked about, again, sort of the nature of how these businesses operate and the red flags that you might be able to see or be able to capture from being outside of these establishments. We've kind of gone through some of the historical seeds that we now kind of can trace to the legacy of what we kind of see today in the reality of this sort of industry growing and thriving across the country. So let's talk about elements of how we move forward. We do not have all the answers. I'll just name that. But we have seen success. And I think part of that success means naming reality and shifting our paradigm. So remember, if we talk about some of the historical challenges of being reactive or not being able to have the resources for long trafficking investigations or using only one approach to kind of do sweeps against women and arrest those who are potentially exploited, this is not working. So the reality check for us is naming this and saying, what can we do differently to shift and ultimately have a winning strategy versus consistently losing against traffickers in this space? I want to name our partner, the Human Trafficking Training Center. They helped co-develop this. And so just naming them as we talk about how we start shifting our paradigm and creating inoperable environments. We would argue that the best way and that what we have seen continually be successful against the illicit massage industry is creating an inoperable environment. What do those elements mean? It starts by understanding the business model. How does this model work? And where are there opportunities ultimately to identify a weakness that we ultimately want to engage and leverage against these traffickers? Third thing is that because illicit massage is going across many disciplines and has no prejudice against different boundaries, we need to work together across businesses as we think about creating this inoperable environment and ultimately actually designing and executing a plan, which may seem silly to name. But often so many of us, regardless of where we are in the space, as a regulator, as a legislator, as an anti-trafficking organization or law enforcement, we just kind of cycle and do what we've done always and never actually stopped and said, how do we kind of shift our perspective, do that in coordination and actually execute a plan versus, well, we've always done it this way, so we're just going to continue doing it that way. And if that's the case, I think we know where we're going to go. It's going to, if we don't change, we're going to have continued growth, meaning continued exploitation, and traffickers will win while we sit here and say, we don't know what to do. So again, understanding the business model. So what does that mean for us? When we look at illicit massage and how it's unique compared to other trafficking or other exploitive industries, one, traffickers by and large use rented space. There are very, 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 very few, and again, we are doing this all over the country, of traffickers and bosses who own the space that they are ultimately working out of. This is a weakness within the business model. A second thing, like all businesses, is that they must advertise, okay? And this leaves a digital footprint that we can capture and ultimately expose the true nature of these businesses. A third weakness is that these businesses, because they're trying to fake legitimacy or trying to have some level of legitimacy, we know, and particularly those on this call, there are so many licenses or permits or things that they need to be able to be certified in to be able to practice if they are legitimate. And the last thing is that they need customers, and these customers, again, love talking about their experiences online. So how can we leverage these things into different tactics and strategies to combat the industry? And so we take these weaknesses and leverage them in a way that we attack these business drivers that we talked about before, really focusing on how do we have a higher level of accountability and particularly targeting the storefront, the safe haven where buyers and traffickers feel a sense of, hey, it's just a massage and there's no consequence for their actions. Well, we are seeing work, and just to speak this over for those, whether you have the ability to launch something like this or not, it's really trying to name what are the things that we're seeing successful in creating interoperable environments. Now, one is what we call LEP, a Landlord Engagement Program. Simply put, it is a high-impact, low-cost strategy that's designed to engage landlords, ultimately to terminate leases or to not renew leases, to decrease the number of illicit massage businesses in a jurisdiction. So what does this entail? Really, it does two things. The Landlord Engagement Program does, one, it informs landlords and property owners about the suspected activity on their property. It does this often through a letter campaign. It educates them within that letter, as well as on calls, about what are those laws and the legal and financial consequences if they do not take action or if they are found liable for this establishment and what's actually occurring, and ultimately motivating them to terminate or not renew a lease for an illicit massage business tenant. Again, often this is taking other ways that people have done this to monitor and regulate alcohol or marijuana establishments, you name it, what has been successful in applying that to these illicit storefronts. And when we do landlord engagement across the country with our different partners, you actually have like these breaking into thirds. You have this immediate impact where a third of the storefronts will close the second they're notified about a letter because they don't want to deal with the risk of financial or legal penalty on their establishment. The second thing is that the second third will close once they have some engagement with the law enforcement, civil office, city attorney, district attorney, or an attorney general, and confronting them on what's actually happening. And the last third is going to where there might be actually more resources spent to be able to do more investigative work to see what's actually happening on these establishments. So the overall results I just want to name are astounding. So the lowest closure rates, again, we would usually ask this question and get responses as we do these trainings. The lowest success rate for landlord engagement for anyone that we supported is 45% closures over time. That's the worst landlord engagement has ever performed as we've supported them across the country. Again, from a state level all the way to local level. The highest closure rate is actually 100%. Giving you one example locally, as much as Maricopa County has been a challenge, I'll just give a shout out to Jason Stout, who's kind of leading efforts in Mesa through their police department. They've targeted what we now have counted 30 illicit massage businesses over 2 years, and through a landlord engagement campaign, has closed all 30. So just one example of a local action through a local police department with a landlord engagement strategy with 100% closure rate. And so without giving all the details into, so how do we do it, how do we break it down, again, landlord engagement, a critical way of being able to eradicate storefronts and keep them closed. We often support this through creating maps of the local jurisdiction, being able to share information for what we're capturing online. Again, all the business information that becomes relevant for engaging these landlords, and being able to give that data away for free, collecting illicit advertisements, again, to showcase what is actually happening in these establishments, and then providing all kinds of strategy and technical assistance to support this execution. Again, we name that there are so many people doing this. You don't need to just utilize us. How do we connect you to show how do you do this well? What are some of those resources that we can share to give you? You don't have to start at zero. What are different places you doing? What is the information you want on that? We often will grab landlord information to help people send this out, and helping best practices when it comes to how do you actually engage a landlord? What does that conversation or a meeting or phone call look like? Again, we provide all of that for our partners who are implementing this across the country. So giving you one example, whether you can engage on this on a partner level or an information sharing level with a local law enforcement or state authority, to be able to engage landlords to create this clearing effect because of the number of businesses needing an alternative way to ultimately disrupt and close these storefronts. The second thing, again, in creating an operable environment is through regulatory enforcement. And again, something that you guys will be well versed on or much closer than someone like us who's doing this across the country and you need to localize this. When we talk about enforcement, really what we're talking is about preventing exploitation in IMBs through really thoughtful regulation and motivated enforcement. And really, when we break these down, what we've seen as we've interviewed folks across the country who have been implementing this in their different jurisdictions at a county or city or even a state level, are two big factors when we think about successful ordinances, the preventative elements and the elements for enforcement. And so what do those mean? So preventative elements, again, thinking off the top of my head, again, some of the stuff, what is obvious? No one who is unlicensed can be practicing massage within an establishment. Having a criminal background check to be able to deny someone if there's any evidence of prostitution or any other criminal activity through a storefront. Any form of prostitution offenses, any personnel changes. So some states and some cities will recommend anybody who's practicing at the establishment having some reporting mechanism to be able to track who is practicing. Client records, again, other elements like that, that if they're not tracking clients, again, having that be an enforcement mechanism that can easily be caught. Some folks even recommended original copies on site of folks who are licensed therapists. Again, just thinking of some elements that might be included in a preventative way. Some of the enforcements, again, that have seemed to be very successful, being able to have within the ordinance the ability to do unanswered inspections, decreasing the amount of time for an immediate closure if there's any violations against the established ordinance. Other things are even around online activity, like where can these businesses not be promoting themselves? And again, targeting the way illicit actors are operating. Sexual activity, if there's any sexual activity that's happened at a property, again, how do you can legislate that to attack these illicit businesses? So you name it, whether it's through the business licensure effect, whether it's through the massage licensing for an individual, whether it's Department of Buildings, Department of Health, code enforcement, who are those that have a role that they can play in being able to help enforce these elements to be able to squeeze out those bad actors within the industry? Again, often when we talk about successful ordinances, the recipe and the goal when thinking about this is always, how do you target and regulate the specific illicit business practices and not the practice of massage, right? How are these illicit businesses operating that are clearly not related to those who are legitimate practitioners, and target those and be able to put those into some form of regulatory offense? Again, the way of thinking about this is, how do you create a barrier to entry of those illicit actors without creating a barrier to legitimate businesses and individual therapists because of how these businesses are operating? Again, obvious ways of what are things that should be illegal, making those actually illegal. And again, preventative elements that help detect hidden ownership or problematic ownership on the front end through an application process so that these illicit actors don't get in the door on the front end. So when we think about this, again, preventative elements, enforcement elements that are ultimately the recipe for having strong regulations that give the tools for those who have oversight to actually act against these illicit practices. I would always summarize this in a way that's often some of the gaps are around time, the gaps around the level of financial or legal consequence for not for a violation, as well as like enforcement mechanisms. So again, if there's a compliance check, if someone has a violation, sometimes the greater gaps of like, oh, someone has 6 months to fix this or 3 months, often that's an opportunity to close. Or if there's a financial consequence, the penalty is so minor that even if somebody has a particular violation, the financial element is too low for how much these businesses are making. So thinking about that time, particularly around compliance, the time when it comes to how much these businesses are frequented to be enforced, elements around financial or legal consequences, and the authority to enforce are, again, ways of thinking about what is that should be going into a regulatory framework. So let me just wrap up and name, if you guys even want a starter point, you can go to the network's website under articles. We have even just a 4-page thing that we've collected over the years from interviewing regulators, massage therapy boards, licensors, you name it, of what has been sort of those best practices. It can go into detail of examples, particularly in jurisdictions, of what they've done, be successful, and what can be adopted or what can be shifted depending on your area and what you think is best to work. In the end, when we think about regulatory enforcement, it is not a solo act. There has to be coordination between those entities who have some level of oversight or jurisdictional power to regulate these businesses, because even the best ordinances need to be enforced in order to see success. And so when we think about the illicit massage industry and just naming all the things that we talked about today as we close, I think it's important just to say, again, this problem has been around for a long time. It has socially been this sort of acceptable kind of practice that even has humor attached to it. When in reality, these businesses are making a ton of money right in front of us, going through these loopholes or just moving around in a way that we can't catch them, continuing to exploit a community with many vulnerabilities. And really what we have to think about is how do we shift our approach to be successful in winning this really, really important kind of challenge. And so any effort for us when we think about combating IMBs is advancing equity and combating the historical prejudice, racist, sexist, and misogynist roots of these establishments. It is going to strengthen the local economy, be keeping the good actors in and the bad actors out. It is going to continue to prevent crime in our communities, because these businesses are not only sexually exploitating, there's so many often other crimes that are happening in these establishments, as well as protecting the public, those who are massage therapists, those who are going to receive massage therapy for healing efforts, and really those, again, who are practicing. And so when we think about combating IMBs, there are so many elements that need to be put into focus as we move towards this work. And so I know that was a lot, and we went fast, and we can't cover everything. But if you want to reach out to us, or if you want to learn more, you can go to our website, look at some of our articles, some of the strategies that we suggest and that kind of showcase others who have been successful. You can reach out to me or contact Angela if you want to talk more about what we can do, or how we work with law enforcement and regulators as we think about creating operable environments in this work. I want to thank everyone for listening. I'll pass it back to Angela as we talk about what we do next.
Thank you so much, Chris. Do you have an opportunity to answer a couple of questions while we've got you?
I absolutely do. I just wanted to make sure that you, to let you answer that question versus me assuming we have the time.
Absolutely. Thank you. So one of the questions that I have for you, and this is just out of curiosity if you've experienced this in other states, last year, we had a bill that was passed that eliminated English proficiency exams in order to qualify for massage therapy. And we do have a high, we have a lot of Hispanics in Arizona. Yes. And I believe that that was one of the reasons why English proficiency was proposed to get rid of. Have you seen other states encounter an elimination of English proficiency? And have you seen any consequences or potential consequences of eliminating English proficiency as far as in the massage therapy industry, as far as licensing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have not, from the work that we've been doing with different states. FSMTB, again, I think Ashley might be on the call, might even have better insight into what they're seeing state to state. The one thing I think, again, this is sort of that challenge, and I love that choice of removing it, because it actually has the potential to expand the workforce and acknowledge, hey, what can someone actually do when it comes to the success of this without having to, like, again, sort of marginalize if English is their second language. I will say this, particularly for those who are being exploited in this space and the bosses within these establishments, they're able to get around, unfortunately, like a lot of this in the first place. So you have folks who are just completely practicing without licensure and not even trying to fake legitimacy that way. For those who are, who I would say are a little more, again, I'll say advanced, they're going to somehow get through the MBLEX, or they're going to somehow get through the test, or they're going to do through memorization. Okay, what are the words that I need to be able to acknowledge and be able to respond to certain exams? And again, Arizona may be different about beyond just taking the assessment. There's other kind of elements they need to do to practice. But whether it's through these sort of completely false, falsified records, or whether it's through this test taking kind of ability that they can get around not speaking English, we've seen sort of it, again, these actors are going to be able to get around it. And that's, again, a question for us. Because what do we do as we think about that? I think obviously there's been efforts against these diploma mills, as we call them, and these fake massage schools. And I remember USA Today put an article about this where a number of folks contributed across the country into shutting some of these down. Obviously a ton are in California. And again, I think those are all smart moves in trying to squeeze out these bad actors. And again, how they're potentially getting around it, no matter what those small changes might be.
Some say that the landlord engagement program has a tendency to scare landlords into discriminating against all massage therapists. Like, they won't let any massage therapist rent from them for fear that they might, potentially get into trouble. So they just eliminate, you know, I'm not going to rent to a massage therapist at all just because of this landlord engagement. How would you, and our board does not have this jurisdiction over establishments, that's a local municipality, as you all probably already know from working with Jason Stout.
Yeah.
What can you say that would, encourage people to, landlords to still rent to the legitimate practitioner?
Yeah.
If this comes into place.
Yeah, this is great. That's a great question. This is where when we're working with local jurisdictions, we're often just sort of naming, personally, before that, before I answer that question, this is why we think it's so critical for any folks who are kind of, again, whether it's a city, county, or at the state level, to be involved or informed about these actions, because you can, again, be very clear about, hey, what is expected, what is not expected, because you guys are within the legitimate side. So, hey, this is what I think is critical, so you don't have actions that aren't being informed by the legitimate practitioner. So that's just my, it's huge emphasis for coordination. I'll tell you, for us in the network, we're constantly sort of shaping this inoperable environment, meeting these two actors. So as much as collaboration is like, oh, let's bring everybody to the table, we don't like collaboration just for collaboration's sake. We're like, the two most critical people here are going to be some of the inciting actors, so whether that's a local police department or an attorney general, and those who are on the regulatory and the board side. Because you guys actually, to me, have the greatest information of who to target, who not to target, and how to shape that program. So I want to name that on the front. The second thing is, when we're working with anybody doing landlord engagement, often so much of this is an educational piece. So the overwhelming majority do this, this is like a spectrum of like informing versus being an adverse, like being very adversarial. It's often right in the middle or to that information side. And so it's not this sort of like target massage period. The reason for that is, again, we think it's been proven more successful, but landlords, for the most part, again, I mentioned the sort of breakdown of thirds, don't want the risk of those who are these illicit actors who are, again, performing some form of what you would call commercial sex or prostitution services. And that's the information and the data they're often being shown to, right? And so when we talk about what's illicit or legitimate, when we talk about moving forward, because they always ask that question, how do I think about this moving forward so I can prevent those bad actors from coming back up, but also creating space because I need to rent my establishment? We always just name, here are the key things. So if someone is a legitimate practitioner, this is what they're going to have, like 1, 2, or 3. In this state or in this county, this is what they would have. And so the majority of illicit actors can't actually have those things, or they have like one falsified thing out of the three. And so that's where often these preventative elements and informing landlords of what is needed gives them they're empowered to know, okay, here's what I can do. The other thing that often landlords will do, and cops will show them this, like if you Google the phone number attached to this person, they're going to be a history if they're promoting themselves online, and it's going to show these illicit activities. So some folks will do that. So again, these are just different ways of informing the landlord, hey, if you're going to evict this illicit actor, what are the legitimate things you need to know? And often that's part of the landlord engagement, and then moving forward about, again, being able to rent the space. This is what legitimate looks like. These are the things that they would have, and these are what folks don't have if they're illicit, is a way for them to be informed about, okay, now they feel secure, they're doing the right thing, and they can also protect themselves from these bad actors.
That's awesome. I think that all of this information would be valuable to the general public, too. I think the general public doesn't know, what a legitimate massage license looks like. And partly, we have a lot of these, maybe not even illicit establishments, but establishments that provide unlicensed massage therapy, whether they're providing, extra services or not.
Hmm.
The general population doesn't know that they're supposed to be licensed, or that, oh, I went to this Thai place and I took on my, anybody, any massage therapist who performs Thai massage work knows that you don't take your clothes off.
Yeah. Sorry, but you know, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think that this would be something that, you know, be beneficial for the public to be aware of as well. Thank you. I'd like to open up the floor to the other board members for questions for Chris as well. I don't want to dominate the conversation if I have.
I don't have any questions. Actually, I think you answered some of them on what was happening in Arizona. And I know that Mesa maybe was doing a little bit of work. Obviously, we have a long way to go. And I just want to say thank you so much for the great presentation. I'm a victim service provider. I run a nonprofit organization. Especially I think in human trafficking, domestic violence, sexual assault. So when you talk about, you know, we're arresting the women or our victims, it's something that has always bothered me, and it's continuing to do the same thing because it's just the leg we have to stand on right now, but it's not working. And so I think I took away and I really valued the approach that was really going to the root cause and not just continuing to do what we're always doing and helping us to have that paradigm shift, which I really appreciated that. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome.
Bob,
Chris, thank you very much for your presentation. Among other things, has your organization developed a model lease?
That's okay. That's great. We do not. So right now, we do not have a model lease. This does get asked about, and whenever that happens, we just try and connect people to like an agency that we've worked with that says, hey, they have like an example lease. I would say the majority of leases kind of cover if there's any of these sort of illicit activities happening, the landlord or property owner has the right to immediately evict. So short answer is no, we don't have a model lease, but I'm actually going to write that down because that might be something that becomes in handy because we do get that question. And for the most part right now, we're often just connecting. We get a question, we'll kind of blast it out to a number of our kind of trust partners, and they'll often just connect directly outside of us. So let me just write that down. Good question, Bob.
Yeah, excellent question, Bob. When I'm thinking about that, I also think about a lot of times what gets missed when somebody is renting a space is how big does the space need to be? What does the space have to have? Showers and bathrooms and just the common things. Sometimes I see municipalities have this incredible amount of requirements in order for a massage therapist to have a practice that are almost unreasonable. But yeah. Yet, and there's others that are, okay, we need to improve this a little bit. It's got to be more than just a closet.
Yeah. That's where, and again, I'll just respond to that, Angela, is like, what is that sort of happy medium? Not because medium is good, but, and I tried to mention this and I know we went fast, but like understanding how the illicit businesses are operating is ultimately what we use against them, whether in a lease or whether in an ordinance. And that's why I think it's so critical to be in conversation. And we would either, I'm always suggesting I'd rather go slow and be really diligent to be very effective versus to go fast because we're motivated and, you know, upset. And then we're creating like a super ordinance that may have ill effect against those who are just like, oh, we're operating legitimate establishments. This is where, again, when you're at the table, you can quickly identify where to parse those out. And again, utilizing how these illicit actors are operating and putting that as the focus versus getting these general actions that, again, are just like over-regulating a business. And that's where, again, there's got to be a fine line. And I think the conversation is critical to be able to make sure what that line is that gives the tools to the right people ultimately to enforce or to prevent actors from getting in, as well as securing the legitimate agency entities and protecting them from any, again, these establishments.
Sure. We still have quite a few municipalities when they have their inspections, the inspections are done by the inspector that also inspects adult entertainment services. Places you can't have a massage establishment within a certain mileage of a school. And they're categorized as adult entertainment or under tattoo shops or something like that. So yeah, it's there's a lot of work that it will always be a lot of work, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
And that's again, sorry, I'll just you see where that element starts. Even when you go back to, there's a lot of legislation around this in Northern California originally, and you put massage in this category because of what it was being presented at and how it was being encountered again through these sort of rest and recreation centers. So again, it's not an accident. For it to still exist now is just like so problematic. You're like, wait, what? But you see those roots sort of again rearing their ugly head, particularly across the country of where this was originally regulated and how just again bananas that sort of is to think about.
Right. We had a bill that popped up very, very recently, HB 2169, that proposed consolidation with cosmetology. And a lot of massage therapists were very much against that because of the perception of being under beauty. Not that it, that, you know, massage therapy is performed in salons and spas, but
sure.
Most massage therapists perceive our services more as healthcare.
Sure.
And the perception of being put in, you know, a beauty regulatory board was a step back for us. So fortunately, we were able to stall things a little bit, and hopefully, improve our board and its function so that, we don't end up in that situation again.
Yeah.
Board member Tapka, do you have anything you'd like to add? Questions, comments?
Yes, thank you, Chairwriter. Thank you, Chris. That was a very concise and informative presentation on a obviously very heavy subject. I too really appreciate you mentioning or emphasizing or actually creating an entire paradigm shift of it's not working to arrest the victim and re-victimize the victim, which I think makes them subject to be victimized even more later, right? Once you're arrested, you can't get a legitimate job. And not that people aren't breaking the law, but those aren't the people that we want to go after. I also appreciate you, mentioning that, you know, excluding an entire culture from the massage industry doesn't really help either. That kind of victimizes a whole group of people and kind of, and I like this getting back to the source of going after the business owner. I guess my question, and I believe in your approach,
yeah.
100%, but even getting more back to the source, can you comment a little bit why it's so hard to arrest the actual owner as opposed to just preventing them from renting? Does that make sense?
Yeah, great question. And totally not a sufficient answer, but let me tell you what I've learned for doing this for like 10 years. And again, you guys will see a certain side of this. Often ownership is so obfuscated, through so much of the different elements, right? So whether you have a shell company, an LLC, multiple names, you name it, you end up chasing an entity or you end up chasing a ghost, or, that paper trail exists, but regardless if you want to, again, legitimacy or not, there's the narrative, oh, well, they've sold it off to somebody else. And so there's a new owner that says, oh no, they're the owner. And this previous person has nothing to do with this establishment, but there's still the paper on record and the complication that goes there. And often, again, this goes into through the dynamics of layers. Like Bailey was saying, my background is in victim service provision. And so being able to work directly or supervise teams working with survivors, there are layers between those who are often we have the most direct access to and those who are ultimately running the operations. And so that is by design. So many criminal entities, even outside of illicit massage, do that to where if you're a courier, you don't know who, what, where, when, why. You're just told to drive and you're threatened that if you don't drive, these will be the consequences. But for many of the women who, again, are the most directly interacted with, again, with the tools that have been so used in the history of combating this, often only have so much information and they're being so regularly moved. They don't even understand who is their primary person of contact and what their sort of level of understanding is. So often they'll say, oh, this is so-and-so. This is who runs the business. But they are actually maybe running the sort of the management of the store. They're not actually the owner, right? And so you have all these sort of layers put into who is actually running the establishment. The last thing, again, it shouldn't be a shock, but again, traffickers are so, I don't want to say brilliant, but sophisticated in how they communicate. Often it's all through different social media handles, or they're through nicknames. So it's not even a legitimate person's name that they're interacting with. So they only know someone by, oh, they only interact on WeChat or through this group chat. And again, so much can get done even through never actually interacting with a person in person. And so you have all of these ways that I would argue decentralize and sort of obfuscate who is actually running the business and how to get to them. The best operations that, again, we're not saying never do criminal investigations. We're just saying if you do them, it can't be built off of a victim cooperation because of the levels of trauma and complication and threat that has been, again, used against them. So often we say don't build it on top of the victim, build it around the victim. And the best way to do that is to remove the central focus on human trafficking and think about it from an all-crime sort of kitchen sink approach. Because there's so many other crimes that are happening in these establishments, money laundering, the Mann Act, they're promoting prostitution. And that, again, some folks have used that to great degree. So for those folks in those areas that have analysts and you go after the financial crimes, that's the best way to target these establishments because you can track the money and you can sort of track these actors. The challenge with that is often those take 18 months to 2 years to actually then implement a case, let alone to get a case to trial if they're going to go to trial. And when you have the volume of illicit massage businesses and the complication that exists, this prioritization becomes challenging. So that's my way long answer. It still doesn't sufficiently answer this when it comes to priorities. Can we just move them out versus try and investigate 100 businesses within a locale? Become a little bit daunting of what prioritization and how to choose that, knowing that the layers in which these businesses are operating are so complex, gets us to, again, where we are today and sort of these challenges that we face. And it's not helpful for us to ignore the challenge. It's just good to name them and to see then what can we do with the resources we have.
No, I love your approach. It's the first practical working approach we have, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you can comment on this, but in a perfect world, in addition to what's working right now, I guess if we had business transparency, like most of the massage establishments in town that are legitimate, I know who owns them. There's a person attached to them, a person that we can arrest if there's bad stuff going on there. It's not hard to figure out. I mean, so I'm assuming in a perfect world with true business transparency, let's say for all massage establishments or all these kind of things where there was really an individual attached who was liable, that would be helpful as well. I realize that's not possible right now, and I actually think you've got a better plan of attack, but I'm assuming that would be an additional, we would be getting more at the source at that point if we could do that.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree. And again, this is where the coordination and sort of like collaboration becomes critical. Like, what are the tools we have and what are the resources we have to do it? And that's not I think sometimes we're always living in ideals. Like, I mean, I do this work because I'm an idealist. Let's be honest about it, right? But I think ideals can get in the reality of practicality. And so we all want the perfect solution. We all want, I shouldn't say like, we all desire to have that sort of perfect solution and perfect outcome. The bad guys locked up. Here's the media article and the headshots. Here's the survivor story that came out of that. And here, you know, we want all of that. And I'm not saying we don't do that, but honestly, there's often not just an acknowledgement if we don't have those resources, particularly our partners in the law enforcement space, don't have those resources. So how do we sort of be honest about that and think about sort of these alternative approaches over time?
Yeah. No, in closing, thank you. That's what I liked most about your entire presentation was that we all have a dream reality that we'd like to see come true, and we all need to live in the gray to get there. So thank you.
Good point, Michael.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. You had mentioned that Kate was with you. Did Kate want to add anything?
Kate had to jump off at 1 o'clock our time. She just recently joined. She's our new coordinator, and so I wanted her to be able to hear and just enjoy kind of like learning in the space. So she just jumped. But thank you for offering that. I really appreciate you, Nate.
Yeah, absolutely. We appreciate your time so much today. You are welcome to do whatever it is that you have to do. We'll be continuing on with our agenda. But thanks once again for all of your knowledge.
We appreciate you. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you. Before we get to the next agenda item of board investigative reviews, I'd like to offer a 10-minute comfort break, please. We are back in session. It is 10:37 a.m. on March 25th, 2024. Agenda item number 8, Upon a vote of the majority of a quorum, the board may go into executive session pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A2 to discuss or consider records exempt by law from the public inspection, including receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is specifically required to be maintained as confidential by state or federal law. We do not have any formal hearings. We do not have any formal board interviews or board we do have investigative reviews today. Our first investigative review is Mark Walker, massage therapist 27398, an expired license. This is a preliminary investigative review of the information available to the board at this time, and it is not a hearing. Is Mark Walker present at this meeting? Please go ahead and unmute if you are.
Yes.
Thank you. And do you have legal counsel with you here today?
No.
Okay, thank you. Investigator Elson, can you please provide a summary of the complaint against Mr. Walker?
Yes, Board Chair. The board received information that respondent worked as an independent contractor licensed massage therapist at the Rim Golf Club and Mountain Spa located in Payson, Arizona between October 2022, and February 22nd, 2024, when his license had expired July 18th, 2023. Furthermore, it was reported that respondent provided a fraudulent massage license to his employer. Based on that information, the board conducted an investigation. On March 7, 2024, board staff received respondent's written statement, and respondent admitted to working on an expired license between July 18, 2023 and February 22, 2024. He additionally admitted to fraudulently presenting a altered massage therapy license that he changed the date on to his employer in an attempt to remain employed there. He did file on February 21st, 2022, board records indicate that he attempted to apply for a renewal. He submitted a credit card payment that was denied. And no further, everything else is still deficient as far as his renewal application. We have no application, no CEs, no level one fingerprint clearance card, anything. The day before, though, he did attempt to purchase a license, but his credit card was denied.
Thank you, Investigator. Mr. Walker, do you have any information that you'd like to present at this time?
Yes, thank you very much. I tried to drive down, but I couldn't because there's ice on the roads up here. But after I applied for that and my card, I don't know how it got denied because I borrowed the money from my dad in my statement, and I made all the recommended payments, and I submitted the final – I submitted my first the online payment as soon as I could. And then I submitted the continuing education and the fingerprint card about 10 to 14 days later when the fingerprint card came in. And so I was under the impression that when I did this afterwards that it went through because I don't have a receipt of my card saying that it was charged, but, actually I think there was like a number that I was supposed to put into my, application, my reference number for payment. So I paid the $97 plus the $40 late fee, $137.50. And I paid that right away. And then because according to, my teacher, Jimmy Gaelis, he said that you could pay that right away and then take your classes and submit it all, but nothing is valid until everything is submitted, which I thought was done on
the end of February, early March. I don't remember exactly what day I got my card in. So I'm confused now with how. Okay.
Well, I know that, you know, there are a lot of people renewing right now. So sometimes it's not something, once you apply, it's not going to happen like right away. It has to, go through the process. Investigator Elson?
I recently pulled him up in the database because the information I gave you was from the time I did the report. It appears that his license, he submitted a renewal application on March 7th, 2024 with his continuing education and a level one fingerprint clearance card. And all that was submitted on March 7th, 2024. And he was relicensed on 3/13/2024. So he's currently active now.
Okay. Thank you for
and,
that.
By March 7th, that was the date that the fingerprint card came in, because that was the last thing I was waiting on. Like, as soon as I found out that I had screwed up so royally, I immediately tried to take the classes and get the fingerprint card and do the things that I had to do that I financially was unable to do last July. But I realized that it was very important that I had to call and beg my dad for the money, and which was really hard to do. But I knew that I knew I couldn't work at that point. And so, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Board members, do you have any questions for the investigator? Board members, do you have any questions for Mr. Walker?
Yes, Chair Rader. This is Board Member Tapscott. So, Mr. Walker, though, but you were working on an expired license before you attempted to reapply, correct?
Yes, but I had completely, for lack of a better term, forgotten that my renewal had expired. In my initial reply letter, I kind of stated what was going on with me at the time last July, and there was a couple factors that...
Mr. Walker, respectfully, yes. I've read that, and I don't mean to be unempathetic.
I get it. Yes, sir.
But my concern is that massage therapy requires a certain level of responsibility.
Yes.
To ensure client safety. And I would think staying up on rules and knowing when to, you know, reapply for your license would be a responsibility we should hold you to, just like we would with other client responsibilities. I understand there's a lot of extenuating circumstances, a lot of detail here, but still, you know, as a licensed practitioner who works on the public in a very intimate matter, I don't mean to use that term, but it is, we would expect you to also be responsible enough to renew a license on time or not work on an expired one. That's my concern is either you forgot it, but do we want somebody practicing who can't kind of stay up on all the rules and stuff, right? And we don't.
Yeah.
And so then the flip side is, hey, you were practicing on an expired license and there's a penalty for that.
Yes. One thing I thought of was, well, as far as the first part goes, I certainly will never forget again. It's been extremely stressful. I got the message loud and clear. And I even thought of a good punishment would be to make me renew like once a year for a couple years to make sure I got the point or something like that, because I'm so ashamed of myself.
Well, Mr. Walker, we're not here to shame you or punish you, really, not in that sense, just to ensure that there is a strong motivation for people to renew their licenses and not practice on an expired license. That's all.
Yes, I got it.
Mr. Roos, Vice Chair DeRoos, do you have any questions for Mr. Walker?
Yeah, I just have one question. Have you practiced at all since you left the Rim Golf Club?
No. I stopped that night, but when my license renewal came in on the 13th, I started practicing again. I've had two clients since then. I've worked on the one that I've always worked on for a year and a half, and a new client last Friday. Yeah. So I've had, but I did tell, and then I have two appointments coming up that I told that I got my license renewed. And, but when it did happen, I stopped practicing until I ended up working for my friend's mom, doing odd jobs around the house just to make some money.
Okay. Thank you. That was my only question.
Board Member Kovitz, do you have any questions for Mr. Walker? Okay. Mr. Walker, I would recommend for you, first of all, if you have a smartphone, which I think a lot of people do at this point, is to open up your calendar and put an alarm on your phone as when you are supposed to renew.
Yeah.
You can renew 60 days before your expiration date, and I highly recommend doing that.
Yeah.
And I actually do that with mine because, you know, time flies. Years go by fast. So my alarm is about to go off in about a week to mm-hmm. start my renewal process.
Yes.
So that way you don't fall behind again. A lot of people, and you're not the only person that has done this. Okay, so based on the information presented at this meeting and contained in the investigative report, I move that I've already got a renewed license. So at this point, I move that the board offer a consent agreement for a $700 civil penalty for practicing without a license and a $1,000 civil penalty for altering and using a fraudulent license. If this is not paid within 90 days, what will we do?
Issue notice of charges.
Issue a notice of charges. Thank you.
Okay. Let me write that down.
And may I have a second?
This is Board Member Tapscott. I second that motion.
And can we do a roll call vote, please, Mr. Auberton?
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member Tapscott.
Aye.
Vice Chair DeRoost?
Aye.
Board Member Kovitz?
Aye.
Chair Ryder?
Aye.
Four ayes, one vacant.
The motion passes. This will be reduced to you in writing, Mr. Walker, by our investigator, and you'll get further details on how to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes this investigative review. Our next investigative review is Stasia Lee, Massage Therapist 25409. This is a preliminary investigative review of the information available to the board at this time, and it is not a hearing. Is Stasia Lee present in this meeting? Please unmute if you are. Investigator Elson, do you know if Stasia Lee I thought she was planning on being here, yes?
Yes, ma'am. I notified her in email on multiple occasions.
Okay. On that note, investigator, would you please provide a summary of the complaint against Ms. Lee?
Yes, Madam Chair. On March 5th, 2024, the board received a complaint from RS. Oh, wait a minute. I think she was popping in. She's muted.
Oh, okay. Ms. Lee, are you on the call?
Yes, ma'am. I'm on the call.
Okay.
I've been on for an hour and a half. I was unmuted. I don't know what happened. I apologize.
Not a problem. Do you have legal counsel with you here today?
No.
Okay. All right. Investigator Elson, please proceed with providing a summary of the complaint against Ms. Lee.
On March 5th, 2024, the board received a complaint from RS that respondent provided massages for her business as an independent contractor between October 28th, 2023 and November 1st, 2023, when her license expired. When her license expired on October 17th, 2023. During the course of the investigation, respondent admitted to practicing those two dates on an expired license.
Okay. Ms. Lee, would you have anything that you would like to present at this time, any information?
Yes, ma'am. I am definitely not the smartest cookie. It's extremely hard for me to navigate through the site. And can you just confirm that you guys can hear me real quick?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. The site is extremely hard to navigate. And I think that I was like the person before me, Mark. I paid the fee. Well, mine went through. I paid the fee and got like a receipt for it. But then I was confused if we could like maybe make the website to where it won't allow you to pay the fee without doing all of the like required stuff. But so I did try to renew it. I believe in October or November. I was not being responded to by the person who answers the board info at Board Massage. I was not being responded to. And when I was receiving just a link. And then I stated to this person, a link to the website. I stated to this person that not everyone understands things the same, at the same level. And I don't know what they're requiring of me. I was not responded to until I contacted the Citizens Aid Ombudsman, and then I was provided with a deficiency list, which I took all the classes, I did all that, and then again, I wasn't responded to for a long time. I had to contact Ombudsman again, and within 48 hours, I had my license. So that's the licensing part. Now, as far as working for Rachel Schuetz goes, yes, I did work for her. She did know that my license was expired, but stated to me she needed help, so she was going to overlook it. She hired me, took my ID, my insurance, all of that, et cetera. I told her I was in the process of renewing, did a few jobs for her. Fast forward to February 24th, I believe, I did another job for her. She wanted to argue with me for 10, 15 minutes outside of her own client's house about licensing and renewing and all stuff like that, like ridiculous stuff. She takes invoices for her business. That's fine. I filled it out. It was incorrect. She started to send me passive-aggressive messages where she's literally stating, you're shortchanging yourself. You filled this out wrong. Next time I'm not going to say anything to you about the tip. I'll just leave it how it is and pay you what you wrote down. And so we got into it again. And she stated she was going to mail the check. That's fine. To this day, I have not received any payment from her. And instead, she has begun to complain about me to every single faucet. So where I am a loud person, if I feel I have to defend myself, Rachel is a dangerous person trying to take away the livelihood of a single mother with a disabled child who does not speak. She's got tumors in her heart. This is why I worked on an expired license, because I have two kids to take care of. I didn't do anything out of malicious intent. And once I was actually communicated with, that I had the deficiency list, I worked on getting that done. I was not communicated with again. Contacted Citizens Aid to finally get my license and be licensed, you know? So I didn't do anything out of malicious intent. I worked during that time because I have two kids to provide for, and this is the only job that affords me that with my daughter's special needs and the tumors and all that. We have so many appointments. So being able to be a mobile therapist and do like a 2-hour job. And then if she has a seizure, I can go pick her up from school. It's not a problem. That's why I continue to work. I have to provide for them. Why was the complaint brought up? Because Rachel hired me and then turned around because she didn't like me, turned around and is trying to ruin my livelihood.
We're not going to make assumptions. Let's try to just stick with the facts of the matter so we understand that RS hired you.
Yes, ma'am.
And that you were unlicensed.
Yes, ma'am.
And you currently have your license.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. Investigator Elson, you have your hand up.
I do. I have a couple things. I can speak to the fact that I did review the licensing database, and the respondent paid for her license in November of 2023, but did not complete an application and provide a level one card and submit continuing education until January 24th, 2024, and was relicensed January 25th, 2024. And I believe the complainant is on this call also, if you want to call on her.
Yes, so we will give the complainant an opportunity to speak as well. So once we got all of the, so this is for the investigator. So once we, so once the licensing received all of the information that we needed for the license, then the license was issued. So it wasn't a matter of, we're just not going to issue this license because we don't feel like it. It was because we didn't have the
We didn't have anything except for the payment since November.
And the license was issued the day after that information was received.
Correct. I show it being received. I show it being received by licensing on January 24th, and her license was made active on January 25th.
Okay. Thank you. Is RS on the call? That would be the claimant.
She was. She is. She might be muted.
Okay. If RS is on the call, please unmute. You will have an opportunity to provide any information at this time regarding the case.
Madam Chair, I also want to make sure I sent out an addendum to this case. It includes text messages at 8:30 this morning.
Yes.
When I received it, to make sure you got that text message.
Yes, we did. I received it. I'm sure the other board members may have received it as well.
She's showing on the call.
RS, if you are on the call, please go ahead and unmute.
Maybe she's going to be the respondent in the next case.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Board members, do you have any questions for Investigator Elson?
This is Board Member Tapscott. Yes, Investigator Elson. So, is it my understanding though that Ms. Lee was practicing on an expired license, not just before it was renewed, but even before the payment was put in?
Yes.
Okay.
Her payment was put in November of 2023.
So
the date that she worked for the RS was November 1st and October 28th.
Gotcha. And so regardless of system confusion or whatever, there was not even an attempt to renew until after working on an expired license.
Correct.
I needed to get the money for the renewal payment. That's why it took me like a week. Sorry, my allergies are going in and out.
Understood. Remember COVID.
Ms. Lee and Mr. Elson. Ms. Lee, between November and January, can you tell us approximately how many massage services you performed?
God, I have no idea. I would have to look in the calendar, but off the top of my head, at least 15, 20. This is my only form of income. While waiting for my license renewal, I did end up taking out a few loans to kind of fix the space in between. But,
The answer is between 15 and 20, you'd say.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
And Vice Chair Bailey DeRoos, do you have any questions for the investigator or for Ms. Lee at this time?
Not necessarily. I think, you know, we understand that you have been working without a license. I mean, and just in full transparency, we want you to work. It kind of is feeling like that we want you to have a license. We want you to work. We just want to make sure that you are getting it renewed on time. And so, you know, you can't work without the license. We do want you to do that. We understand you have the livelihood and how important it is. And with it being that important to you and your family, just like previous, just make sure that you have to renew on time. You can do it beforehand. And that's important. And especially when you're saying it's this important, you can't go without it, then making that a priority is just my maybe suggestion, but I don't necessarily have a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Investigator Olson, do you have anything else?
No, I'm attempting to reach RS by telephone now.
Okay, thank you. Based upon the information presented at this meeting and contained in the investigative report, I move that the board offer a consent agreement for a $500 civil penalty. If not signed and paid within 60 days, issue a notice of charges. May I have a second?
This is Board Member Tapscott. I second that motion.
And can we do a roll call vote, please, Mr. Augerton?
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member Kovitz?
Aye.
Vice Chair DeRoost?
Aye.
Chair Ryder?
Aye.
Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
4 ayes, 1 vacant.
The motion passes. And that concludes this investigative review. Your information, Ms. Lee, will be sent to you by our investigator for further instruction.
Thank you.
Our next investigative review is Rachel Schuetz, Massage Therapist 11200. This is a preliminary investigation review of the information available to the board at this time, and it is not a hearing. Is Rachel Schuetz present at this meeting at this time?
This is Rachel. Can you hear me?
Yes, Rachel. Could you pull up?
Okay, sorry. I was on earlier. It just wasn't letting me speak, so.
Sure. Rachel, pronounce your last name for me, please.
Shoot.
Okay, thank you. Rachel, do you have any counsel here with you today?
I do not, no.
Okay. Investigator Elfin, will you please provide a summary of the complaint against Mr. Schuetz?
Yes, Madam Chair. On March 14, 2024, SL completed a complaint form alleging respondent hired her to perform massages, knowing that SL's license was expired. During the course of the investigation, SL admitted she performed massages for respondent's business while her license was expired and that respondent was allegedly aware of her license was expired. On March 19th, board staff interviewed respondent telephonically. Respondent denied knowingly allowing SL to work on an expired license. Additionally, once respondent found out SL's license was expired, she stopped contracting her until her license was once again active. SL provided some text messages and a written statement that was forwarded to you this morning.
Okay. Board members, if you have not had an opportunity, please check your emails right now. Let's review those text messages just so that we're all on the same page here. I'm just going to take a moment. Investigator, I have a question regarding the information that you've passed on to us, because it appears that in the text message that she may have been aware that that the license was expired based on the conversation? Am I reading that incorrectly?
Let me go to it myself. So on November 2nd, let's see.
I just want to make sure I'm getting the timeline right. So the text messages are on November 2nd. The work performed was before November 2nd, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Ms. Schutz, did you hire SL for any other work after November 2nd?
No, not until she was licensed again.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions from the board members for the investigator? Okay. Ms. Schutz, I would like to give you an opportunity to present any information at this time. Please go ahead.
The only thing that I can say is she's lying. I did not know that her license was expired, as you can tell by the text. She did not mention that it was expired at all. I was not desperate enough for help that I would have used an unlicensed massage therapist. There's plenty that are licensed that I could have used and easily have found somebody. So she's just doing this because I filed a complaint against her.
Are there any questions from the board members for Ms. Schutz? Okay. Yes, Board Member Tascott.
Thank you, Chair Ryder. I don't have a question I have a question for the board. I think the evidence supports that she did not know. I think the real question here is what obligations does somebody who's subcontracting work out have to verify licensure? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm asking the board members that I think we need to discuss that in this case.
I think in my opinion, in all situations where there's an employer, and especially one who is a massage therapist as well, should be looking into and asking for a valid massage therapy license in order to practice. I think that's just, it's common knowledge. I mean, for me, it's common knowledge. So just as we're asking for other paperwork, for tax purposes, that the license should be the number one thing we're looking for.
Right. And it'd be very.
I do have something in regards to that. In my defense, with the contractors I have used over the years, I typically do verify their license. This one time, I talked to her on the 28th, and I used her services the 25th, and used her services on the 28th. I was told she worked with another company. I was told, she said she had her own business. I had a lot of stuff going on. So this one time, so on the 2nd, I did get a chance and verified it. But I had, assumed that being a licensed professional and a business owner and being told that she could work for other people, that she was licensed. And I will admit it was my lapse, and I should have verified that, and I typically do, but I typically get people on my team well before I actually need them as well. So this was one time slip on that part.
Thank you for that. Board Member Kovitz, do you have any questions that you would like to ask Vice Chair DeRoost?
I don't. Thank you.
Okay. based upon the information presented at this meeting and contained in the investigative report, I move that the board dismiss the complaint due to lack of supporting evidence. I think that in a situation like this, all business owners need to be checking the validity of the license holders that they're hiring. So I'm sure, Ms. Schutz, that you will not make that mistake again. On that note, I move that the board dismiss the complaint.
I'll second that
motion. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I will definitely not make that mistake again.
Can we do a roll call vote, please, Mr. Augerton? We do have a second from Board Member Kovitz.
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Chair Ryder?
Aye.
Vice Chair DeRoost?
Aye.
Board Member Tapscott?
He already aye'd.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll double aye.
Four ayes, one bacon. Sorry about that.
The motion passes. And that concludes this investigative review. Next on our agenda, license application requiring board public review, we have Michael Wilhelm applicant. This is an application requiring a public board review. It is, and I'd like to find out if Mr. Michael Wilhelm is present in this meeting.
I am here, ma'am.
Thank you. Are you represented by any counsel?
I am not.
Okay. Investigator Elson, will you please provide a summary of this applicant and that requires a public board review?
Yes, Madam Chair. It's going to be lengthy. On August 17, 2023, the board received information. Applicant displayed the following behavior. Propensity to violent with staff and clients. He stated that his uncle pushed his background check through. He stated he was in federal prison and currently involved in gangs. He told the complainant this, she was not sure if it was true. He told her that he had pulled guns on people. He told her that he had pushed drugs. He expressed he has major anger issues, anxiety, and PTSD, which he displayed on 8/14/2023 to her. He stated that he got kicked out of the Navy for being a drug mule. He stated that he's going to court on Friday because he pulled a gun on a coworker. And he stated that the whole time he was in massage therapy school, he was on absence. She believed that he should not be in massage therapy. He should not be licensed in massage therapy as he has a propensity to hurt people. I received a written statement from the respondent. In his written statement, I'm quoting, I'm not going to deny the allegations. I was not in a good space and stated that things were either true or a fabrication of the truth. And that's all I have on that.
Okay. Thank you for that, investigator. Mr. Wilhelm, would you please provide any information that you would like to with the board at this time?
Yes, ma'am. So like the investigator just said, proving it or stuff, but none of that stuff is true. During those times, I recently did just get out of the military. I got out of the military in 2021, so now it's been about 3 years. Since October or maybe August, but I know I've been seeing my therapist for at least a year. I started seeking counseling, therapy for all my PTSD of my time, my service, the things I have been through, being deployed and all that stuff, and in the active duty Marine Corps for about 4 years. With the federal prison, all that stuff, you can obviously see that. Like, when my anxiety kicks in back then, I always used to just say things that, in hence, would make me kind of seem like a badass because I thought people were looking down on me. Random things would just pop out of my mouth. I would say things that I didn't mean, or I would say things that like just weren't true or just who wasn't me. And then since then, I became like a father to a newborn baby girl in November, got a stepson now, so pretty much family of four within a year, kind of changed my life around and started seeking the help for my mental for about a year now, and just kind of started making improvements on building my life and building a life for me and my family.
Thank you. Mr. Wilhelm, when you had first started sharing information, I just want to be clear, because you had mentioned to the investigator that you did not, that you were not denying the allegations. And I believe you, I just heard you say that none of that was true. So could you clarify your position on that? Were in the complaint, were those allegations in fact true?
What I was trying to say is I'm not denying, but I'm not saying it was true either. I did get kicked out for smoking weed, which I will come clean with. Because my mental health got so bad, I was on the verge of just like committing suicide and all that stuff. And I couldn't be in anymore. And it was a matter of life or death at that point.
Okay.
That was the only thing I was kind of agreeing with.
Okay. Board members, do you have any questions for Investigator Elson first? Board members, do you have any questions for Mr. Wilhelm?
Sorry, I do have a question. Maybe for one or either of them. He has passed a background check, right? Are there any, actual charges to follow up on any of these things that have come up beyond, you know, mental health? Are there, because there's some allegations in here. I'm just wondering if there's been any charges, and does he have his clearance?
No, his background check came back okay. So that without this complaint, we probably would have licensed him. I did discuss with the Assistant Attorney General, Casey, about a psychological evaluation prior to licensing, but our board doesn't have the authority to authorize a psych eval. So that's really not an option prior to licensing.
Okay. Board members, any questions for Mr. Wilhelm?
Mr. Wilhelm, this is Board Member Tapscott. If I understand you correctly, you did make the statements that you made, but the statements were not true. Is that correct?
Correct. Just when my anxiety kind of kicked in, I'll just say things.
What effect do you think that had on the individuals that you were making those statements to?
I will admit that it probably did make them feel uncomfortable, and I went home literally crying in my car that day, calling my mom, because I realized what I did right then and there. Because I always realize what I did when it happens, and then I always regret what I did. And I knew it probably made them feel uncomfortable and unsafe, and that my intention with everything I do is not to make anyone feel unsafe or anything. I want everyone to feel safe and protected when they're around me.
And would you agree that's probably the number one goal of any massage therapist is to make their clients feel safe?
Yes, sir.
My concern is what would happen if a client was lying naked on your table, covered, and you started making statements like that, how I would feel in a room if somebody started talking that way in a highly vulnerable position already.
No, I get that. And I wouldn't want to put anyone in that position. And I know that they go there for specific things and, to get away from things. And I want them to be that, like their little getaway.
Thank you. So one more question. So since that happens with your anxiety and such, what reassurances do we have that that will not happen in a massage room? If we give you a massage license,
is there? I guess you could just say all on my word. Like I can say that I know nothing like this will happen again, because I noticed a huge change. My parents said they've seen huge changes in me ever since I've been seeing my therapist. Like I was seeing my therapist for every Friday for like almost a whole year, and just recently started going down to every other week because I wanted to go all out with my therapist and seek the help and everything.
Okay. Thank you for your frank answers. I just want to point out, if it did happen in a massage room, even if no physical action occurs, it's still an assaulting action. So that's just what
okay.
I'm concerned about it. Yeah.
If we okay. Were,
yeah.
Board Member Kovitz. Go ahead and unmute.
Mr. Wilhelm, this is Board Member Kovitz. This board cannot require you to submit some kind of a mental health report or something from a therapist that would violate patient and therapist confidentiality. Would you be willing voluntarily to submit something of that nature to this board?
Yes, I actually would. I actually, when I first heard about this case, I only heard about this case about a week and a half ago. Is when I first started hearing from the investigator, like the investigator was a couple months ago, but then the case I just started hearing about a week and a half ago. Sorry, what was that question again? I kind of got a little sidetracked.
Okay, Mr. Wilhelm, we can't require you to submit some kind of a report from a qualified mental health therapist. But if
About 2 weeks ago when I heard about this, I actually talked to my therapist about a little letter that if you want to write anything up for me or anything that you guys possibly want, he said that he would do it for you.
All right, thank you. We can't require it. I think it would be good to have it on the record if you want to submit it voluntarily. But I'm not sure we can do much beyond that.
Can I ask a question to the board? Because I'm struggling with this a little bit, that we're really now doing what if and regulating people's mental health. When he's saying he's done the things that he needs to do and the tools, we can question that. But if he has a cleared background check and he's saying, I've done what I need to do, I'm really struggling with us. It's just a slippery slope, in my opinion, for anybody else who has, because a lot of people have mental health. It's a very, very common thing. I guess I'm posing the question of, like, what is, I know it's within our scope, but just from the board members, I'm kind of curious what your guys' feelings are, because this is feeling a little outside of our scope, but maybe not.
Thank you for that, Vice Chair. Board Member Tapscott, do you have a comment?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Chair Ryder. Vice Chair DeRoos, I agree with you. Despite my questions, I just want to make sure that the individual understood what might happen if these scenarios happen. But I agree with you. I think we can't come down on what if scenarios. I just want to make sure that we are very clear on what the intentions are for creating client safety in a room, and that we would be acting in a very different manner if we were to see this individual under different circumstances at a different time. But I admit this person has met licensing requirements, and we definitely can't. I think it's outside our realm, and I think it's a very slippery slope. You're absolutely right.
We have a couple of different options here. So, I personally am not leaning towards denying the license at all, but I am concerned about the history, that has been given. But on the upside, Mr. Wilhelm has been seeking therapy and is being proactive in his mental health. And it seems like things have turned around a little bit for him. One of the other options that we have is if we issue a license, we could do a consent agreement for a 12-month probation that includes stipulations such as working under the supervision of another rather than not working as an independent contractor or mobile therapist. That is an option. That option would not come up unless, because he had, this previous complaint, which he has admitted to, that he has said that some of those things, and some of those things were not accurate, some of them were. So I think in the matter of public safety, working under somebody else's supervision under a probationary period, could be an option, and then he'd still have the opportunity to provide for his new family.
I thank you for putting that out there. I agree with not, denying, but I love the idea of maybe a little extra support and monitoring that way, and I think that's a great option.
And that provides that public safety aspect as well. Investigator Elson?
Did you want me to go over, did you receive the stipulation sheet attached to the report?
I did not see the stipulation sheet.
Did it say stip sheet?
I did not get that.
So the probation is for just a safety probation, basically, is that it's standard probation for 12 months. Upon being issued a license, it would be marked probation. He'd be responsible for quarterly performance evaluations by an employer quarterly, and he has to have on-site supervision for the year rather than direct, as long as there's a supervisor in the building. And we mentioned to come back at the end of 1 year, come back before the board to remove the probation.
Okay. And then would it be appropriate to, although the board does not require it and it is not in the stipulations, that if Mr. Wilhelm wanted to just voluntarily include a status report from his mental health practitioner, that he could do that?
It wouldn't, we couldn't put it in the stip sheet, but I mean, if he sends me something from his therapist, I will save it to his file to denote it when he comes back before the board.
Okay.
I mean, his file's a permanent there, permanently with us for 10 years anyway. I'll include anything and then mention it when he comes back before the board in 1 year.
Okay. Board Member Kovitz?
Madam Chair, that would satisfy my concern, the stipulation sheet and anything that would be provided voluntarily. I could live with that.
Okay. Then I will go ahead and create a motion. Based on the information presented at this meeting and the findings of fact and statute rule violations identified in the investigative report, I move upon meeting all license requirements and signing a consent agreement for a minimum of 12-month probation to include in a stipulation sheet that the board grant licensure. If not signed and all licensure requirements are met within 30 days, deny licensure.
This is Board Member Tapscott. I second that motion.
And a roll call vote, please, Mr. Alderton.
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member Kovitz?
Aye.
Vice Chair DeRoost?
Aye.
Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Chair Ryder?
Aye.
4 ayes.
The motion passes. So, Mr. Wilhelm, what that means is that the investigator will be contacting you with the details of that once you get all of your license requirements in and you pay the consent agreement, and you will be on probation for 12 months, but you will be able to have a license.
Thank you very much. I appreciate everything.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You guys too.
Next on agenda, item number 9, Investigator David Elson, once again, will be providing a monthly activity status report on incoming state board complaints and current ongoing investigations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Between last meeting and this meeting, we received 14 new complaints, 7 of which were closed by the executive director's authority for being either not, that weren't statutorily within our preview. We processed 89 cents of fingerprints back and sent off to DPS for fingerprinting processing, and we only received 30 back in the month, this month, back from DPS. Furthermore, what y'all asked me to look into last board meeting, I've reviewed statutes. Casey's reviewed the statutes for me also, and I've been in contact with DPS, and there's nothing that says, if the board approves it, that schools may submit fingerprints for their students, 90 days prior to graduation. That way we're solving the 90-day problem with DPS. The last set of prints that came back from DPS actually did take just under 90 days to get back from the FBI. But if they start submitting 90 days beforehand, it's looking like by the time they're eligible for a license and graduate that we should have those FBI fingerprints back.
Very good. Very good. Item number 10 on the agenda. So that brings us to, yes, Board Member Ted.
I just have a clarifying question. I appreciate that. But Investigator Elson, would they also need to, I know this hasn't happened yet, but they also need to submit an application so that you can link up those fingerprints. So in a way, they're going to submit an application that says, I intend on graduating 90 days out here.
Yes, and that's where we're going next.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Nope, don't be sorry. You just preempted me here. So item number 10 on our agenda, this is regarding our special meeting and that particular policy that we were talking about. So we discussed initiating a policy to permit the submission of the hard copy SD-258 fingerprint cards to state board for the customary 3-month processing to obtain national criminal background checks when future applicants are within 90 to 120 days prior to the school graduation. Investigator Olson was able to investigate this and found that there were no contraindications from DPS at this time. This would be accompanied by an initial state license online application and paid licensing fee to the state of Arizona. Upon graduation, the final required credentials would be the school's approved student transcripts, validating the hours of the program completion. So for added clarification, if the initial application and FD-258 fingerprint card and payment are received within 90 to 120 days of one's expected graduation from an approved program, this would significantly speed up the licensing process that many of the schools have complained about. In addition, I also want to, I know that, and this is going to be a question maybe for licensing, because I'm not sure how this is happening, if it's only with some schools or if it's with all schools. I know we moved everything to online. Online applications are going to be, they're not going to get lost in the 3 mail rooms that it takes to get to the board. Okay, so really the only things that we should be getting via mail are the FD-258s. Everything else can be emailed. And so there's less of an opportunity for it to get lost anywhere before it gets to the board and have missing items. This is the main complaint. So if everything's done online, minus the FD-258, there's really no, I think we're eliminating a lot of the board lost my stuff, which is, one of the frequent complaints, and the licensing is taking too long. Well, there's the second. It's two birds with one stone, right? The other thing that I see with this is that I know some schools, with the financial aid, how they have their payment set up, what have you, there's been some expressed concern about what if the student doesn't graduate, then we're out the money, for paying for the application fee and what have you. I think that, the majority of the massage therapists have indicated during this whole last bill proposal that we want to be a part of healthcare, that we want to be perceived as part of healthcare. And one of the steps in doing that is becoming proactive and responsible on maintaining, obtaining our license. And part of that is being financially responsible. And I think that the application fee as well as the fingerprinting fees, what are we looking at, investigator? Like about $400 maybe for all of that. In the beginning of the program, if they're getting a clearance card, which I always recommend because that allows the school to say, hey, yes, you are a good candidate for our program because you have a level 1 clearance. That's the first step. If they were doing it 120 days or 90 days before they're graduating, that gives them plenty of time to make sure that they have the money to be financially responsible as a professional. all of these other healthcare boards, they expect the same thing of those license holders as well. So I don't think that massage therapists should be treated special. Yes, we're special in many ways. But if we want to hold ourselves to those standards, we have to behave like that. And I think adding this piece to the licensing process and making it easier for everybody is a win-win for the applicants, for the schools, for the board staff. It adds a layer of consistency. If everybody's doing it, if everybody's on board, everybody's happy. So that was my rant. board members, anything you want to add to that? Board member Tascott.
Chair Ryder, I could hardly call that a rant. That was a riveting, well-explained, you captured all the facets and everything, and I would agree with you. I appreciate the humor, too. I would agree with you that really we're not exactly changing that much. You always had to pay for your license up front. You didn't know if it was going to be approved, right? I mean, there's always things that could happen. And by the time they are 4 or 5 months through their program, they have a fairly good idea of whether they're going to graduate or not. That's the gamble you take. You don't have to take that gamble. We're not making people apply early. They can apply after they graduate. They don't have to take that risk if it's a risk to them. And we're just allowing applications to start the background check early. And I would hope this would also, in a small way, help the office of the board not get rushed by a whole bunch of applications all at once, right? Just keep them coming in. I realize the volume's still there. I don't think this is some magic fix for the staff of the board, but I do think it's a really good start. It gets to the root of the problem, and the root of the problem isn't the board. The root of the problem is the background check. And so I think it's a wonderful thing that doesn't affect the law or anything. It's just a simple, administrative change. Anyway, so I just applaud this approach.
Thank you. Vice Chair DeRuth?
Yeah, I agree. I don't have much more to add. I think you actually both said it very nicely, and I fully support this. I think it can be a good thing, and so hopefully we'll help speed up the process and overall expedite and make people happier to get their license quicker and working faster.
Absolutely. I think at the end of the day, it kind of moves that accountability to the applicants as well as the schools, and it takes some of the burden off of the board of as far as where's my this, where's my that, where am I, who am I, where are my things, it just opens that communication up a little bit better as well as far as what's deficient. Every applicant will get the deficiency that they are missing their transcripts. That's just that they can expect that. But there should be nothing else in that deficiency list. And so if they have the deficiency of the transcript, then we know that we're doing it correctly. Board Member Kovitz, do you have anything?
Madam Chair, normally I wouldn't choose to get involved in administrative issues, but I can make an exception in this particular case. Anything that reflects positively on the board and the office that moves the process along and allows people to practice their professions, I'm certainly in favor of.
Thank you. All right, on that note, that I move that the board initiate the policy to permit the submission of the hard copy FD-258 fingerprint cards to state board for customary 3-month processing to obtain national criminal background check within 90 to 120 days prior to the school graduation. May I have a second?
This is Board Member Tapscott. I second that motion.
And can we do a roll call vote, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. Vice Chair DeRoos?
Aye.
Board Member Kovitz?
Aye.
Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Chair Ryder?
Aye.
4 ayes.
The motion. And that concludes this agenda item. Next, we have a report from the Executive Director. Take it away, Tom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I can be brief here. Some of you are aware of the fact, because this came up during House Bill 2169, that at one of the meetings we were joined by the Arizona Auditor General, and we were provided with a list of questions that they wanted answers to subsequent to the original audit and then subsequent to the six-month follow-up that the board provided. Each of you received a copy of those questions, and each of you received a copy of the responses generated by the staff. That was submitted on March the 20th. The following day, on March the 21st, we got another set of questions that were a follow-up to the prior questionnaire, and that is due today at close of business. So you'll be getting an updated list of questions from the Auditor General, and then we'll be sending you a list of the updated answers that will be provided today before close of business. That's issue number one. That's all the information I have at this time. And as has been stated earlier, the State Board will discontinue on June 30th of 2025. And the presumption is that we will be hearing from legislative players, members, and staff as to what will be transpiring during the off season when the session is over, if there will be anything pre-filed legislatively regarding the board, and then there would have to be legislative intervention in the 2025 session. Otherwise, the alternative would be the industry would be deregulated and the board would be expired on June the 30th. The board also received a letter on March the 18th, which has been copied to each of you, from the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. And we are now facing a deadline of June the 28th of this year to submit our five-year regulatory review report to the GRC. And as Mara Concordia referred to at the outset of the meeting today, it was last done 5 years ago, and in fact, she was volunteering for Salt, was volunteering back then on that specific issue, and we've gone around the sun five times since then, so it's back again. I've already met with our outside outside counsel, Jessica Ross, and she is available to help us once again, like she did 5 years ago. For those of you who don't know, Jessica is an attorney who came from the Governor's Regulatory Review Council and is familiar with the process both from her prior tenure there and also from providing assistance to various state entities since then. The letter, as you saw, offered an opportunity for us to obtain a 120-day extension from GRC for this compliance. I am not recommending to the board that that needs to be requested. We are confident that we can respond in a written report to GRC in advance of the deadline, the June 28th. There are more requirements this time than there were 5 years ago, including kind of a hybrid spreadsheet. So, but we do believe that we can complete this and get it to the board for review prior to the deadline in June. So, it's already begun. That work has already begun. And we'll have status reports for you at each meeting. The final issue is Centia. Centia has been our traveling companion for 2.5 years, going on 3. They are moving ahead with their preparation of a demonstration set of software for the board. I think most of you who have been here for a while know that we're working with an outside vendor called Gould Intelligent, who actually works for a number of other state regulatory boards, to be basically our project manager with this effort, not only based on complexity, but based on the other things that we're trying to do at the same time. So they have been filing our compliance reports with the Arizona Department of Administration, what's known as a PIDGE report, which is the detailed monthly status of all the complexities involved in this database conversion. So originally, as you'll recall from last year, this was expected to be onboarded in the first quarter of this year. That deadline has not been met. But I would offer to you now, based on the current status, that we're looking at the database conversion beginning by summer. And if you're looking for a more precise date, like what month is summer, I would say would be close to probably the end of the fiscal year and the early part of the new fiscal year of July, just based on where things are at. We have been through 4 team leaders, for lack of a more sophisticated term, with Ventia. In about the last 4 months, And then we lost our engagement manager, which is our liaison with the Arizona Department of Administration, Karen Whiteford, who had been so helpful to us for so many years with Ventia and other issues. But the good news is we live in a small town, relatively speaking, and she now works for Ventia. So she's providing her good shepherding for the corporate, as well as, I'm hoping, her residual affection for the board and its limited resources. So that's the latest on Ventia. The discussion earlier regarding the FBI card and so forth, the majority, and I think we're one of the few final ones of the Arizona regulatory boards dealing with health industries, health-related industries, have all gone to full automation. So the preparation of what a number of the applicants have been going through by doing online, and, you know, it sounds so good when the chair says, well, we do online licensing, and I could be confessing this in public, but is online licensing run by Hamster? So we do need everybody to apply with the online application form, but when it comes through the cloud and the server farms and all of the brilliance of Silicon Valley, it still ends on Tony's desk where he hand key punches everything that the person has just provided online into the database, which was established in 2010. So we're not quite there yet, but with the arrival of Ventia, the applicant's relationship with the board will be very comparable to someone with a medical portal. You'll be able to access it 24 hours a day. You'll be able to upload the required items. You'll be able to generate some type of responses at that moment, not waiting for our single licensing person who's currently supporting 13,000 active licensees, he said editorially. So when Ventia gets here, it will be more comparable to what applicants have a right to expect from an industry regulatory environment. So 2024, not promising any miracles or any improved Google reviews, but it should be able to provide people who just want to go to work the ability to get their license within their lifetime and not on a protracted basis continually. So I think that's all I have, Madam Chair. We're also watching some other bills of the state legislature, we being the 90-10 regulatory boards and particularly the health boards. There are a number of proposals out there dealing with required changes in board compliance on investigations and complaints. And we'll wait to see what finally shakes out and if anything's approved this year. And if we receive any more correspondence from the Arizona Auditor General's office following today's submission, we, of course, will get that to the board. And I think that's all I have here right this second.
Thank you, Executive Director. Board members, are there any items that you would like to see on our next agenda, which is going to be in May?
I just have a quick question for our executive director. Now that we have another board member, do we have any cases that need to move forward that were held back because of not having, like, conflict of interest, not having a quorum, that kind of stuff, or are we good?
Madam Chair and Mr. Tapscott, yes, there are two cases that have come up recently. I'll ask David to give the current status, but you are correct. When you've got folks entering the industry from education, it's possible that you might see them again and not necessarily at the homecoming dance. So, yes, there are two cases now that Mr. Kovitz has arrived. When he and I spoke for the first time, I think he thought that we were overly anxious to see him, and I don't think he knew what the reason was. But I explained it wasn't the fact that he was our only Pima County representative from Tucson, and we didn't do a lot of U of A talk. But that his arrival literally meant that the board would be able to function at full capacity, which it hasn't for, well, a while, since Mariah Moon, the former vice chair, left. So I think he understood his importance to us was legendary, but also critical. And so those two cases, you could ask Mr. Tapscott, let's ask the investigator for the current status on those.
Tom is right. There's two cases that'll be brought to the next meeting. I could have brought one of them this meeting, but I wasn't sure if that we wanted to hear those before the new board member had been to an orientation type deal. So I'll have them for the next meeting.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I wanted to ask the board, we don't have bios currently posted on the website. Mr. Kovitz was going to be offering us one, and I thought I would extend the invitation to you and the other board members. If you'd like to provide, you know, a couple of paragraphs on your background, we can post those on the existing architecture of the website.
Sure. Yeah.
And one thing I did forget, now that I got the mic back again, you're going to have to try it from me, but there is a meeting scheduled this week with Gould Intelligent over, is it feasible or possible that something can be done with the website prior to the fact that DOA still has no funding? So we're going to be investigating on what platform might be possible and what new product might be possible. And if we can't do it currently within the fiscal year or with the funding available, at least we can come back and tell the board what the current status of the website is other than outdated. So we'll provide that information.
I'm sure the public would really appreciate that too. I would like to have us review the beginning of this meeting, the recording, the call to public, and potentially add the call to public information to our next meeting for discussion. So that's going to be reviewing some rules and statutes on our end and what our jurisdiction is as far as mobile massage goes. I think that's definitely worth looking into a little bit further. So I would like to see that on the next agenda. Our next board meeting, we are skipping April. Our next board meeting is going to be May 20th, 2024, 9 a.m. to be held virtually. And before we adjourn, a couple of things. After we adjourn, there's going to be a post-meeting new board member training by the Arizona Assistant Attorney General's Office. And for our newest board member, Bob Kovitz, the public is welcome to remain on and see how that process goes, but I will be adjourning the meeting before then. But before we adjourn, I'd like to make, yes, Casey, please go ahead.
I'd also add, if anyone's waiting for that with bated breath, a lot of it's going to be legal advice, so I probably need to set up a second. So it's not to be advising anyone in the public a second room, but I will try and separate the two.
Well, it would be for observation only, as most of the board meetings are. You don't have a call to public, so if anybody finds that information interesting, they're welcome to stay on, but they don't have to. Before we adjourn, I would like to make one special mention before we go that our one and only licensed processor of the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy, who maintains pretty much everything. He kind of runs the board, IT, license processing, everything. Tony Wilcox, it was his birthday yesterday. So, yes, I knew, and I'm shouting it out to everybody so that they can tell you happy birthday. So happy birthday, Tony. You are appreciated more than you know, for all of your hard work. So thank you. On that note, this meeting is adjourned.